I want to continue. And, I mean, yes, this is a discussion class, but because we have somebody here who particularly likes to fight with me, the way we decided to do this discussion is that first I talk and then we argue. Otherwise, all we do is argue and then nobody else.
We'll let you talk 5 minutes and then we
have. All right, give me 5 minutes. Then we can argue.
I'd say give him 15.
Didn't even give me one. Look at this. Not even one. Not even 1 minute.
You didn't get by, you did it.
Okay. No, you can't make a comment.
I can't make a comment? Your character. No, go ahead.
I'd like, because I haven't been to any of these classes. I'd like to actually, forget it. But I would like to
hear what I have to say.
Hear what you have to say.
Last week, I did a kind of a review. This class is a sort of continuation, this class, whatever this is, a sort of continuation of some conversations that have been going on for quite a while in the format of a formal class in one respect. And what that formal class was it was called Everyday Emptiness, but basically it was about kitchen practice in the context of meditating on emptiness in the kitchen or something along those lines is generally what it was about. And we just thought maybe it'd be interesting to continue having this conversation. So last week I wanted to review something that we had probably talked about during the earlier class, or maybe we had and I wasn't sure. Pull up a chair. And that was that three arguments for emptiness, or three ways of understanding emptiness, or what emptiness means. And so I reviewed them. And for the benefit of those of you who were here last week, I'll just reiterate them, although I'm not going to go into any detail. And the three arguments for emptiness, or the three reasons why things are said to be empty, is that all phenomena are compounds, which means they're made up out of smaller parts. And all compounds are products, which is to say that they arise in dependence on causes and conditions. And all compounds or all things only have the characteristics our minds impute to them or imagine are in their nature. And so a quickie example of that would be, say, this microphone, which could be, we'll take as an example of anything, which we call a microphone, but if we were actually to look very closely at it, we'd see that it's a bunch of plastic pieces and wires and metal and stuff like that. That actually, in truth, what's there is not a, quote, microphone exactly, but a compound of many parts that in our minds we see as one entity called a microphone. And we could ascertain that analytically by trying to decide whether or not the microphone ends where the cord begins or whether the microphone includes the cord. Because the definition of a microphone is that it records, or it's involved in recording a voice, say. Without a wire, not much is going to happen. So this is just to suggest that there's a kind of arbitrary nature to things, that our minds draw lines in certain places, that we choose to draw lines and sees compounded things as being singular entities and chooses moment by moment to ignore the fact that every entity is really a flow of existence depending on certain causes and conditions. So maybe that's so brief that it doesn't make any sense at all. But anyhow, we spent about an hour and a half talking about this last week. And that's where I wanted to start from this evening. And I wanted to actually start by telling a story, though, so the abstraction, we can set the abstraction aside for a moment. And that is that what all this analysis tends to do is to suggest that things, as we understand them, entities, is another word, or phenomena, are somehow unreal, even though they appear quite real to us. From a Buddhist point of view, in some way, phenomena somehow seem to be unreal. So I was thinking about this last week, as I was cooking, I think it was miso soup. And I've observed that of all the things I do in the kitchen, what I like to do best is cook soup. And that, I mean, you know, a lot of things can be done. I mean, there's a lot of vegetables that can be chopped up. And if you spend the morning cutting carrots the way I did this morning, what you have is a bucket full of carrot pieces at the end of the morning, which is okay, but there's something about just having a bucket full of carrot pieces that doesn't make the morning feel quite so as having a big pot full of soup when you're done with the morning's work, which is somehow more everything, I don't know, the morning feels much more satisfactory when you're putting pieces of things together to make something, like a pot of soup. And then there's this one moment where you carry it out into the dining room, this wonderful pot of soup, and then suddenly it disperses into all these little bowls and people eat it and no more pot of soup. But there's one moment, well, a few minutes, where there's this product, this complete wonderful thing that one has been creating all morning. And it struck me as somehow ironic that the previous night or something like that, I spent the entire evening talking about the way in which all things, all products, are fundamentally unreal. And then the next day, I'm in the kitchen and I'm discovering that what I really like doing is putting together out of pieces this presumed thing, which, I mean, how is a pot of soup a thing anyhow? I mean, by what manner is a pot of soup a thing? And yet there's a kind of experience of creative joy and pleasure in putting it together. So I was reflecting on that, and these seem to be contradictory points of view. One thing I'm talking about emptiness in the evening, and the next thing I'm talking about the joy, or I'm experiencing the joyfulness of making a thing, which is a pot of soup, the next day, and aren't these contradictory? And what kind of a weird Buddhist would I be if I didn't notice that? Well, actually, they're not contradictory, and that's an important point, and that's sort of the thing I wanted to focus on, which is that from an analytic point of view, if I were to sort of, after putting this pot of soup down, you know, and before we ring the umpan, or to stand there for a while and really look at what was there, as I said, from an analytic point of view, I would see that what was there was, you know, cast iron or stainless steel pot, a lot of water, some vegetables floating around. A lot of people are there in the soup, you know, myself mixing things together, the Tenzo, who decided what the soup was going to be, because without Tenzo's decision, that particular pot of soup wouldn't have been there. All the people who were involved in prepping the soup, they're all there in the soup. All the people who were, you know, growing the vegetables in the fields. So we've been through this kind of, you know, analytic view of the soup before. And that's the way, that analysis is sort of the analysis that I was talking about in seeing how it is that things are composed of parts and how things arise in dependence on causes and conditions. You know, the carrots that are growing in the fields, and Daniel harvesting the carrots, although we don't grow carrots, it's still my favorite metaphor. Are we growing carrots now?
Oh, yeah. Oh, good stories have permeated the field.
Oh, good. So now I can feel less guilty about talking about carrots. That's good. Anyhow, so analytically, all those things are there, and there's really not anything there which is like, you know, a pot of soup, if you do this kind of analytic thinking. By the way, this is actually, in the Buddhist tradition, there's three kinds of meditative practice. And the kind that we do in Zazen is actually a combination of two, as I think it was Norman who pointed out, which is sort of a shamatha, or calming meditation, and a vipassana, or looking closely at things, and a certain type of analytic meditation, or a focusing meditation is probably a better way of phrasing it. The third type is what's called an analytic meditation, and it's just what I described. You know, looking at a pot of soup and looking at what's actually there, using your mind to literally analyze what's there. What we usually just call thinking is actually called analytic meditation. So, if you do an analytic meditation, the pot of soup basically disappears into its elements and its constituent human beings who brought that pot of soup there. And if you continue to perform that analytic meditation, you'll see the pot of soup disappear and turn into Zen students before your very eyes over the course of that afternoon. And in truth, from the flow of things, that's all that's actually there. I mean, that flow that I just described, from the fields to the walk-in, through the Tenzo's mind, through the hands of the people in the kitchen, out onto the table, and turning itself into Zen students. That's the actual truth of things from the point of view of the flow. But in fact, you have to sort of analyze. You have to use your mind to see that. And then the pot of soup disappears. And that seems to be contradicting the whole experience I have of creating. I mean, there's like a deep feeling of creativity and positivity in creating a pot of soup, which would seem to be at variance with this experience. But in fact, in creating a pot of soup, I'm not doing an analytic meditation. In creating a pot of soup, I'm doing something quite different. And the difference is spoken of in middle way philosophy, which was called Madhyamaka, the Sanskrit word for it, spoken of by people like Nagarjuna, under a rubric called the Two Truths, which is the truth, which is to say there are, which is not truth and falsehood, but two truthful ways of understanding reality. And the two truths are the truth of how things appear conventionally, if you're seeing things correctly, and the truth of how things appear in their ultimate sense. And what this means is the way things appear from the meditation cushion. Maybe the best way to understand this. When Buddhists talk about things like emptiness, when you read scriptures like the Heart Sutra, it's very important to determine whether any particular statement is spoken from the point of view of what's called the ultimate truth or from the point of view of what's called the conventional truth. And these sometimes seem contradictory. And the scriptures rarely tell you that they're speaking from one point of view or the other. For example, I say the scriptures, if the Buddha is speaking something, he won't necessarily say in the scripture, you know, the ultimate truth of things is this, or the conventional truth of things is that. He'll just say this is where it's at, and you have to figure out which it is. So, for example, in the Heart Sutra, when it says there are no eyes, no ears, okay, this means from the point of view of the ultimate truth of things. When it says that form is emptiness, this is from the point of view of the ultimate truth of things. But when it says emptiness is form, this is from the point of view of the conventional truth of things. What this means is, if you're sitting on the meditation cushion and you're deeply, deeply involved in, say, the practice of Zazen, what begins to happen is the detailed complexity of experience disappears. And you're left with a kind of quality of nothing in particular, of not noticing distinctions in certain kinds of ways. If all you're doing is staring at the white wall ahead of you, and you're refusing to be caught by any train of thought, so that no train of thought occurs to form any particular sense of reality in your mind, then nothing in particular is left, right? If nothing in particular is left, then there's no world of detail that you can relate to. Everything has this quality of emptiness in the sense of nothing particular is there. That's sort of the absolute, sort of the ultimate truth of things. It's the point of view of sitting on the cushion in deep, deep concentration, where there's nothing particular around. Okay. And from that point of view also, there's no pot of soup. Although I've described a way to get there through an analytic meditation rather than through Zazen, it comes to the same thing. There's no pot of soup from this meditative point of view. But when you're not sitting Zazen, or when you're not performing this kind of analysis, and you're just going around in your daily life, pots of soup appear. Okay. And that's all right. See? Because there's no soup from the point of view of Zazen, but there's soup from the point of view of working in the kitchen. And that's what I was reflecting on when I was noticing that I enjoy making soup so much. Which is, if I was like deeply into this kind of analytic point of view or meditative point of view, I don't think there'd be any difference at all between cutting a gallon and a half of carrots and making 8 gallons of soup. It would come to the same thing, probably. But in fact, that's not my experience. Because when I'm in the kitchen, working at the level of detail, I find that there is a difference. And there's a difference between cutting 1.5 gallons of carrots and cooking 8 gallons of soup, which is, there's a product in one case and not in the other. And although it's given that in an ultimate sense that product doesn't exist, conventionally speaking, in the world in which we all live, that product really does exist. Because, in fact, if the product didn't exist, when we rang the umpan and 60 Zen students came in and there was no pot of soup, believe me, we know that that product existed in a certain way. Okay, we would get that message very clearly. I think that it's really important to think about this distinction because I think it's easy to fall into a kind of almost Puritan-like attitude toward our daily life, which can sort of, you know, like from a Zen perspective, a Puritan attitude toward our daily life, in which we can sort of eviscerate the joyful aspects of just what is ordinary in life, you know, of the distinctions of the creative aspect of life, and even the unpleasant aspect of life, under this notion that, well, it's all empty, nothing's real anyhow, so I can't permit myself to be joyful about this or sad about that. You know? But that's true. From an ultimate point of view, it's true. From the point of view of the meditation cushion, but from the point of view of actually practically speaking, getting on moment by moment in the world, there's another truth. Now, these two truths don't discount each other. They don't. One doesn't prove the other false. That's why they're called the two truths. They're both true. It's just that one is true from the point of view of just ordinary worldly engagement when our minds are functioning, creating the illusion-like experiences we're always having. Not illusory, illusion-like experiences we're always having, that pots of soup exist. And the other is true from the point of view of the meditation cushion, where no pot of soup can be found. They're both true. And it's, the issue is our state of mind. Now, it may be the case that some Zen masters can work in the kitchen in the exact same way they sit on the meditation cushion. That might be possible, or it might not be possible. I don't actually know. It's very hard for me to imagine how it would be possible to cut lots of carrots, keep your fingers, and not make distinctions. Or maybe I got that wrong. How would it be possible to cut lots of carrots, not make distinctions, and keep your fingers? That's what I wanted to say. Now, maybe it's a shortcoming in my understanding. But it seems to me that if you don't draw the distinction between the finger and the carrot, you're likely to lose the finger, the knife. And that if you keep your fingers when you're cutting the carrots, then you're making distinctions, which means you're not floating in the realm of the ultimate truth of things. I heard a story that many students came to Zen Center 10, 15 years ago from the arts. There were many artists that came here, musicians and what have you. And that a lot of them, for one reason or another, seem to have given up their practice of music or painting or whatever. And maybe it's okay if it was a distraction from developing skill in meditation or something like that. But maybe it wasn't okay if those things are given up for the wrong reason. If they were seen as invalid in some fundamental way, because they're just things of the world, or because they were somehow creative activity, and that somehow that was related to ego and distinctiveness and things like that, then I think that was a loss. because I think that maybe a mistake was made along the way there. In fact, you know, nobody wants to eat unseasoned food in the dining room. Nobody wants just to have brown rice coming out of the kitchen for breakfast, lunch, and dinner 7 days a week. Okay. We want different kinds of food. Our bodies demand different kinds of food. And on top of that, if we don't get curry once in a while, we're missing the boat in some fundamental way, and we feel that. And then people start slipping off to Mill Valley to go to Jenny Lenz or something like that because we need it, you know, because that's, we live in this world. No, I think we do need it. I don't think it's that we think we need it. I think we do need it. I really do. You know, I've hung around some really great lamas, for example, and they really they like good food, and they like it seasoned in different kinds of ways, and they weren't lacking in the development of wisdom, you know. And they and my own lama was a total fan of samurai movies, you know. I mean, it's like it's like these qualities of ordinariness I haven't noticed getting lost.
You know, I very often have
a
feeling that you
have a
section.
Sure, why not? I'm finished. Go ahead.
That this, that in Gringos, that all that what we focus on is food, where we have this ordinary sense that we try to kind of cut down everything else, so what is left, more left is more or less is food, which and that's where we actually, I mean, I feel like I really have a hard time not eating too much here. It's like extremely difficult.
Yeah.
And I heard that same people over and over again, and I can feel that that has a lot to do with there is nothing else that really attracts my senses.
Mm.
Like, we have all these issues about sexuality, we have all these issues about creativity, painting, or whatever. So, you know, a lot of what's left in nurturing or attracting the senses is eating.
Yeah.
And there's this question that I really have, that I for myself feel there is something that I need to nurture, and that I do want to nurture, and that I feel is actually I want to combine it and into my practice, and I don't want to push it into a corner, because I feel that it's kind of it's a human thing. It's something. It's an attraction that is life itself in some way. Even if it's dangerous.
Makes me think of the motorcycle rider I was seeing this morning.
Motorcycle rider?
Rider, yeah. Makes me think of my own youth when I rode motorcycles. It's a dangerous life. Thought that occurred to me when you were saying this. I think in some ways I agree with you. In some ways, I'm not sure if I agree with you in every respect, and especially in regards to the role of food here at Green Gulch. But I did think someplace along the way, I don't remember what it was. It's because I was having these dreams about dentists. And my analyst said, oh yeah, dentists. Well, dentists are really interesting when they appear in your dreams. Because the teeth, right, are the place where the outer world and the inner world meet. Right? Because when we're eating, what we're doing is we're taking physically the outer world and we're joining it physically the inner world.
Mm-hmm.
And so dentists have a certain kind of significance, a psychoanalytic significance in dreams, because they mediate the relationship between the outer world and the inner world. So there, save yourself a lot of money in case you happen to have dreams of dentists. So I found that really very interesting. Okay. But I got to thinking about that from the point of view also of eating, because you know, why is it that we have this thing, you know, about food in so many different ways? I mean, for example, you know, Sunday Lee did this entire really interesting talk about food as communion, as an example of interdependence, and so on. He went on and on and on, and everyone got it. I mean, you know, I sit in the back of the Zendo every Sunday when the talks are going on. You can see, you know, whose talks are having what kind of effect on the people in the Zendo, and how many people's minds are wandering, their minds are wandering, like, you know, it's like this. How many people are falling asleep, how many people are electrified. And he did a really homey, simple, straightforward talk about the spiritual dimension of food, and he had everybody in the Zendo. He had all their attention. It was really interesting. Anyway, so I've thought a lot about food, and I thought a lot about this question that mm-hmm. you've raised about why is this so central here?
Mm-hmm.
And I think at one level, though, it is a matter of, as he said, almost like a community communion mm-hmm. when we all come together in the dining room.
Yeah,
you know, that's part of it.
Yeah.
But there is this other quality of, say, food in the context of Orioki.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Or food in the context of really thinking about what's going on at that particular moment when we're eating, or why we feel the need to eat. And I think it has something to do with establishing something to do with this boundary between inside and outside, you know. And maybe someone else can sort of fill in the spaces of my thinking on this issue, because I'm not quite sure where it goes from there. But I think that it goes somewhere.
I would just say that the word boundary strikes me as not too accurate, because there's no boundary. There's a line. There's a definite line. But there's not a boundary. I mean, there's nothing really. I mean, on one level, the Tutu is right. On one level, there is an outside and an inside. But actually, there is no inside or outside. There's just wholeness.
From the point of view of the ultimate, there's no two.
Right.
There's no two things. But from the point of view of the conventional, there are two things.
Right. For instance, we embody both levels at all times.
Right. That's true. But I find it kind of questionable to try and eat rice from the point of view of the ultimate truth of things. See, I find that trying to focus on the ultimate is a physically paralytic process.
Oh, no, it's totally amusing.
It's
utterly amusing. It's not paralytic.
I mean,
just
I find...
Just imagine. You take a spoonful of rice, and you bring it closer and closer and closer and closer and closer. It disappears. It just disappears.
You mean like when it goes in your mouth, or perceptually?
Well, you've never actually seen it go in your mouth, have you? You don't know it goes in your mouth.
I've never seen it.
Yes,
that's true.
That's my point. That's why it's
quite. But it
senses it. But there are other senses that are, you know, useful.
Yes. Well, they do suggest that it goes in your mouth. But...
Well, now, wait a minute. You're saying that truth only exists in your eyes, but not in your mm-hmm. not in your ability to touch or to taste or to smell?
Okay.
Or hear?
No, I'm just saying that if you want to analyze, like you were talking before about analyzing, that you really can't... I mean, you really can't be sure what happens to it when it disappears, because you can't see it.
That's true.
And you can't feel it.
You can't feel it.
But you don't know for sure. And that's what I'm just saying. It's amusing, because the rice actually goes to disappear. It just disappears. It goes into an empty space.
Well,
it just disappears. And it's amusing.
But another way of thinking about it disappearing is that it becomes part of you.
Sure. Yeah, it becomes your fuel or your body. You incorporate the outside into your inside.
Right. So it's not like it disappears. It more, it's like it communes.
Transforms.
Yeah, like the Chinese, one of their characters, I think, for cooking, for a mouth, is a cauldron.
Ooh.
Yeah, it's a cauldron, which represents transformation.
Mm.
May I ask a question?
Of course.
What did you, you go into what you meant about it being paralytic?
When I get into focusing closely on the ultimate truth or the ultimate nature of things, I find that my ability to act, either from the point of view of body or to speak or act from the point of view of mind, stops. Because you have to have kind of a one-pointed attention. to get into this level of ultimacy. And when you have that kind of one-pointed attention, I find movement very difficult. Now, like I say, this may be a limitation in my experience. It may be that there are Zen masters who maintain this kind of one-pointedness of the absoluteness of things and are able to negotiate the world. But I'm not. And my understanding of what this state of mind is like when it's fully developed is that it basically only occurs in deep meditation. That it's not the sort of thing that occurs when one's physically engaged in the world. So my experience is that when I'm engaged in some dimension of multiplicity, if I begin to focus my mind on the ultimate nature of things, then things get paralytic in the sense that I stop. I can't move.
Physically or figuratively?
In every respect. Right. Yeah, it's like my body. I can't move my body anymore because the capacity to move stops and my mind stops. Well, that makes sense. At one point, in this, the mind would stop. So that quality of you know, like, here's the ground, and there's the leaves on the ground, and there's the path, and there's the rocks, and, like, I want to stay on the path and not step on the rocks, and these kinds of things. I mean, it's literally, not figuratively. You know, it's like, in order to maintain that, I really have to have a moving mind that recognizes the diversity of things. I mean, my experience is pretty limited, so it's much more useful to speak to what the texts have to say than what my own experience is. What the texts have to say is that when one is contemplating emptiness, to deeply contemplate emptiness, one does that on the meditation cushion. And I'm not really familiar with any of the Indian or Tibetan texts that talk about contemplating emptiness in this way while one is actually engaged in the world. And I found that I've had one or two experiences myself where I'll be doing something like circumambulation, which is like walking around a shrine of some sort, doing mantras and getting into deeper and deeper meditation. And I find that I actually find it very difficult keep up the circumambulation, and if I get in really deeply, I have to go sit down. And as a matter of fact, I had one experience about a year ago when I was in India where, you know, it's one of those sort of spontaneous things that comes up, like very visionary, you know, and very engaging, deep experience. And it was about sort of the interconnectedness of things. In fact, what it was I was walking around in the temple at one of the temples in Dharamsala, and every time I walk by a certain spot, there's a certain hunk of concrete that had sort of flaked up, you know, because the concrete wasn't really solid there, and sort of it had flaked up from all the people walking there. And every time I walked by, I would look at that, and I would think of all the people that had walked by and the people that laid the concrete and what have you. And I literally had kind of a visionary experience of interconnectedness, looking in this gap in the concrete at one time going around, where, like, I saw thousands of people in this gap, you know, people who were laying concrete, people who were, like, making donations to the temple to buy the concrete, all the people that had stepped in that spot to cause it to flake up, all the rain that had fallen there to seep in. It was like all in that one little gap. And I couldn't move after that. I mean, I saw that as I was walking, and it, like, stunned me. And it so disoriented me that I had to go sit down. Because it was like my abilities to negotiate the physical world in that state of mind had basically stopped. And I basically had to sit there for a while. I wasn't in any hurry for ordinary reality to come back, but of course it did. And then I could get up and do more circumambulations. So that's what I mean by it's sort of paralytic. You know, it just like stops you in a certain way. It's been my experience. If it comes spontaneously. But when you're cultivating it, they really talk about sitting still on the cushion and cultivating it in this way. It's not something, this level is probably not something you want to try and cultivate. I want to give you an example of cutting carrots. Because you have to be paying attention to diversity.
What about really helps, I can verbalize, I've been thinking about it for so long. when you're doing one thing and you're aware of all the things that are going through your mind, or the things that you're seeing, images that you're seeing, what is, I'm going to try to formulate a question out of that. The experience that you had where you had to go sit down, it was something more than just a flash. It was something. Do you know what I'm saying? Like, do you ever read a book and the things that you're reading are triggering off other things that you've learned in the past?
Mm-hmm.
So you start to like digest.
Mm-hmm.
It's something, you're talking about something completely different than that, are you not? You're talking about something
so.
That.
Well, I think they're related to each other, but I do think that I was talking about something different. Sam, I don't know what question it is that is on your mind, but
I'm not sure either, but I think I just had to say that and then I'll get to the question.
I mean, there. While you're thinking about the question, I'll make one comment, which is that we think we have a mind, like there's something on our mind. And when you actually look at the way the Sanskrit speaks about this, it doesn't actually speak about a mind. It speaks about minds. Actually, the literature talks about moments of mind. Because every moment is actually the arising of a different mind. And we think we have a mind because we watch the continuity of the moments, and they go by so fast, like the flashing. Not an incandescent bulb, but a
strobe.
No, I mean, you know, not neon.
Fluorescent.
What?
Fluorescent.
Thank you. In a fluorescent light, I'm losing it really deeply. In a fluorescent light, you know, the light actually flashes on and off 60 cycles, 60 times in a second. But that's faster than the threshold of our vision. So we see a continuum of light. It's not actually there. It's really flashing 68 times a second. The mind is like that, according to traditional Buddhist teaching. Although it's actually 51 flashes in a finger snap. Or is it 53? It's either 51 or 53.
The mind?
Yeah. Either 51 or 53 moments of mind in one finger snap. But we're basically our minds.
Who did ever count that?
Great meditators.
David told me it was 64.
Is it 64?
Yeah, I remember 64 too.
Is it 64?
You're talking to David.
Well, we'll have to consult one of the books. And he's someplace between 51 and 64.
Maybe when you're excited.
Moments of mind.
Yeah.
Anyhow.
I heard like 38 in the blink of an eye. 38.
You heard that? I don't know, where did you hear that? Okay. Maybe an eye blinks twice the speed of a finger snap. Or half the speed. Whatever. Anyhow, the basic point is that what we experience as a continuum is not. Okay. I mean, excuse me. What we can experience as an entity is not. It's rather a continuum of moments of minds arising. And in each of those little moments, to analyze what your experience was in the traditional way. In each of those moments, something new has occurred. In one moment, your attention is on a word on the page. In the next moment, it's on a memory that was evoked by that word. In the next moment, it's the birds and the trees. In the next moment, it's the association to the memory. And the next moment, it's maybe the next word. And then you see it's like that. And all this stuff is going on all the time. And that would be the analysis of the experience that you're having. Anyway, I don't know if that relates to the question that you haven't been able to formulate or not, but I just thought I'd mention that. Still can't formulate the question.
I think that I'm thinking about what you were talking about earlier. I'm wondering if the difference between and pardon my language if I'm not using the right words.
Don't worry about it.
But living practically and then sitting on the cushion.
Talking about the two truths.
Right. If the difference is, if the difference between the two are truly letting go and like being right in the moment, or pushing things down, like repressing things. And did that go way too far out? But see, I've been thinking about that for so long.
Well,
like what the difference is, because sometimes it can seem that you're really, you know, really free and just really, and then you find out later that you're, you know,
oh, falsely free.
Yeah, you know, right here.
Yeah.
But all this stuff is lined up right here that you still need to be still with, so you can, you know, let it out or let it pass or whatever.
Well, isn't that, I think that that's very much the method of Zazen, as, for example, Reb would teach it, that very much the point of a dimension of our practice is to allow that stuff that you describe as being lined up to appear and go its course in some way. I don't know specifically that that relates to the experience I had that I was talking about with the crack or the fracture in the concrete, which is a different kind of experience. In regards to the question of how that fits into the theory of the two truths and sitting on the meditation cushion versus being active in the world, it's sort of intermediate. It's sort of a kind of sitting on the cushion where there's so much going on that it's manifesting, but you're not in a state of one-pointedness. You're kind of evacuating a backlog of unconscious material or repressed material. And if you were trying to be in a state of one-pointedness at that time, you would only be reinforcing the repression. And that would be a false sense of freedom to follow the kind of image that you're using. Whereas to relax and allow that stuff to come up and go its way, then you might be able to move into a state of a deeper freedom where that stuff isn't being held away. But that's still that sort of intermediary in the context of kind of meditation I'm talking about, because it's to meditate on the ultimate nature of things is achieved on the one hand through focused concentration, extraordinary one-pointedness of mind, so that you're not being distracted, and also through a kind of an analytic process where you know what to pay attention to. In the Zen tradition, it's similar to one-pointedly focusing on a koan, or maybe one-pointedly focusing on breath, or something like that. My own particular training isn't that strong in Zen. So I use a lot of concepts and images that come out of a different tradition, where one would consider the meaning of emptiness in the way in which I've talked about it and apply that meaning to some phenomenon like the white wall in front of one, and then one pointedly focus on that. And that sense of the ultimate truth of things would begin to appear. But all those kinds of thoughts that are arising in the way that you're talking about would be considered sort of distractions that you had to deal with before you can even get into that state of mind that I'm talking about, that you have to clear away. It's like a process that's earlier in the training. And having this kind of one-pointed state of mind on the ultimate nature of things is actually a remarkable achievement when you can pull it off. It comes late in training, not early. It's not an easy thing to have achieved. I don't know if that helps. Maybe a little bit. Right. Try again another time. But Roberto had a question. Did you have a comment you want to make on that? That would help her?
It may be related, but not directly enough. I was interested that you were speaking of the two truths, the absolute as being analytical.
So let me come back to that I mean, because we have kind of a queue.
What?
We have kind of a queue in which we go to have the next question.
I mean, I can imagine a connection, but it's not right there.
Okay. See, I thought if you had something that would clarify, I thought that if you had something that would clarify the question that she asked, then I'd give you the floor to help her out. But if you have a question for me, then Roberto gets the next thought.
And I'm in there too.
I'm in too. Yeah. Okay. Go ahead. And we can see later.
Okay. I'm in my traffic cop mode here.
No, it's okay. Mm-hmm.
Okay, I was thinking in the like Emperor Wu. What merit would we have in sitting in a cushion and developing this emptiness, or really engaging in it completely in a practical use for our daily lives, if we are, here's the ultimate truth, which is truth, ultimately, and here's the other truth, which we fully engage in doing the things that we do daily, and if the Buddha is engaged, it's completely join these two halves together and it's functioning perfectly now, but they give us, you know, they confuse us by like not telling us what is, how are we supposed to figure out, you know, or how do we, or how, why are we doing this if it's not, if we can't somehow, I mean, it does with practice, we get to a point maybe where we can see the ultimate truth of the nature of things and ourselves, and at the same time engage fully in the physical world?
Good question. Yeah. Good question. Let me go back to the Emperor Wu bit.
What merit is it?
Because actually the encounter of Bodhidharma and the Emperor is interesting, but I would turn it a little bit. Like, it's quite pertinent to the issue you're raising, but I would turn it a little bit. Because as I recall the story, Bodhidharma goes and sees the emperor, or actually the emperor says, come see me, the way it is. And I think the emperor says, well, now I've built all these temples, what merit have I accumulated? And Bodhidharma says, none
whatsoever.
And the emperor says, what? You know, go away, I don't want to hear this. Okay, well, now it seems Let me try and wrap them all together. And if I don't quite get it, you know, tell me that I missed a part.
You need another question from Emperor
Bodhidharma. All right. Well, let me just sort of leave it with this one. this is enough for the moment. Bodhidharma is answering the question from the point of view of the ultimate truth of things, right? And the emperor is not getting that. That's it. Right? So, from the ultimate point of view, you can't say that there's temples or there's not temples, or building a temple is any different than building a shit house, frankly. From that point of view, there's no difference, right? So why is there more merit to building a temple than, you know, doing anything else in the kingdom? So Bodhidharma said, forget it, there isn't, from that point of view. But from the practical point of view, and this is why our minds have trouble with it, from the conventional point of view, there is merit, and there's also demerit. If there wasn't, there'd be no morality in Buddhism. But there is. Now you ask the question, all right, well, great, so what's the point of seeing this? I mean, does it mean that what life is about is sitting in a cave for 12 years and staring at a wall and that's it? I mean, that would seem to be the logical outcome of seeing things, but I would say seeing things only one-sidedly. Again, in my own tradition, they talk about, well, I guess I have two traditions now. In my Tibetan tradition, they talk about the experiences of the conventional and the ultimate bleeding into each other and informing each other. And this is actually then turns out to be something that's a very practical import. If you're sitting in the meditation cushion and you're having this sort of experience of ultimacy, you say, well, what good does that do for my everyday life in the world? I mean, I still have to pay attention to the difference between a finger and a carrot, or I'm going to be in trouble. And then you could say, well, the same question, when I'm sitting there and I'm cutting the carrots, what's that got to do with my meditation practice in the Zendo, where I'm trying to achieve this kind of ultimate understanding of things? Well, apparently, because I'm no expert on this, what the texts have to say is that as you practice, the experiences of the two begin to bleed into each other and inform each other in a certain way. Okay, so that sort of the rigid disconnectedness of objects in the world, even when you're in the ordinary state of things, doesn't seem so rigidly disconnected because of the experiences you've had of, basically we can say, the non-dualness of things when you've been meditating. That there's a way in which, because it's really the same continuum of mind that's had both experiences, the realization of one begins to inform the other. Okay, so the disconnectedness of the way most people experience daily life for an accomplished meditator begins to disappear and is replaced by a sense of connectedness and permeableness or interpenetratingness, I guess I'm trying to say, based upon the experiences of meditation of non-duality. And in fact, one can say also that the capacity to cultivate this one-pointedness of mind in the Zendo is improved by being mindful about what one is doing in the conventional sense and sharpening one's attention in the complexity of life, that capacity carries its way into the Zendo. I mean, again, to be sort of like, tell a story, be a little bit more practical. I remember in like 1970 or something like that, living in an ashram that was full of people who had sort of like blown their minds on various kinds of drugs and like were showing up on the doorstep in various states of psychic disarray. And they'd be living at this ashram, and people would get really crazy after a while, you know. All kinds of weird stuff would happen. And the Swami who was running it would say, when your mind is driving you totally crazy in that way, what you do is you take a toothbrush and you go and clean off the front stoop of this townhouse, which is in New York City, right? So he would live, and he didn't mean that just figuratively. He meant you find a totally ordinary, mundane task, and you just do it. And all the craziness of your mind can just flow into that task. But then there's something practical. So instead of bouncing all over the place, you're being focused, and you know, just like that. So if you move away from the sort of extremity of that example, you know, any of the work that we do that's done mindfully and with attention really improves our capacity to meditate, to sit zazen. And the experience we have meditating, where we really deeply settle into our natures, carries back into the experience outside of the meditative session and informs it and changes it in a certain kind of a way. Because if that weren't the case, it would be no different working in the kitchen at Green Gulch than it would be working in the front office of any business in the Bay Area or working in the kitchen in any restaurant in the Bay Area. But it's not the same. It really isn't the same, and I think that that's the reason why, you know, at the level of people's experiences. So I think that answered the question that you were raising.
I just wanted to add to that because I remember you saying this once before, and it's something that obviously stayed with me when I thought about it before. Anyway, in terms of why bother or what difference does it make, is feel more connection with everything and everybody, but it also, through that, creates or enhances or enlarges our sense of appreciation and compassion and kindness and gratitude and respect. I mean, all those things flow out of the sense of interconnectedness. If you really go deeply into the sitting on the cushion and bringing it into your daily life. And those seem to make it worthwhile. Appreciation.
Yeah, there's a place where I found that that this practice, although it may not necessarily seem to focus on it, generates, on the one hand, gratitude, and on the other hand, love. Which is to say that it's possible for me to eat a meal in a totally unconscious and coarse fashion. I do plenty of that. But if I'm sitting in the dining room and I really kind of stop for a minute and kind of look at what I'm doing, like this evening, you know, eating this, I'm realizing that my friends were working in the kitchen, making this meal, and sort of a sense of gratitude you know, to the kitchen people comes up in me as I'm eating, because I mean the food didn't just magically appear there, and that just sort of spontaneously happens. You could say, well, it just spontaneously happens because you're looking in the kitchen, but that's not so, because you know we can be in a lot of situations where that kind of, where the opportunity for that feeling to come up might be there, but it doesn't. It requires something on our side. And the other thing is this thing about love. If I'm, say, cutting carrots, and I'm really very deeply into contemplating how the carrot got to me on the cutting board, who was involved in bringing it there, and all these kinds of things, I find that I actually notice the carrot more completely and with more appreciation. And I notice that the carrot gets beautiful, gets more beautiful. And at a physical level, what I actually notice happening is that my chest will soften, and I can actually feel the relationship between my chest and my arm and the knife and the carrot and my eyeballs and some sort of thing about the flow of time. And there's like a feeling that comes out in relationship to that. There's like a love for the food that emerges as a result of seeing how these things fit together. And that feeling doesn't emerge as long as I see everything in this kind of disconnected utilitarian jumble of like, here's a bunch of carrots that have to be cut up and then I can go on to the next task. That kind of feeling doesn't emerge. You know. So because I'm a pretty cognitive person, I often neglect to mention that side of things. But it's certainly there in my experience. And that transforms what's going on also. And in fact, by the way, it transforms other people's experience of the food. Because it's when those feelings emerge in me as the cook that I get the best responses for what goes out into the dining room. You know, when those feelings aren't there, people may remark on the soup tasting good or not tasting good, but there's a different quality of response when the food is prepared with love. Yeah. You're right, sure. It should be obvious, but it's not.
Yeah.
But it's not. And there's a funny, I mean, it's a weird world in which it would be a revelation to me that that's true. But I have to confess to the fact that it was a revelation to me that that's true. Because we're also desensitized to the reality of things. We do live in that kind of world. And there is a way in which I think this kind of meditation and interconnectedness is like repairing the damage done to us by our world. I have a professor friend who says that we're all recovering Cartesians, by which he means, you know, the so-called split in our minds that is embodied in René Descartes' famous philosophy of subject and object and mind and matter being separate from each other, has sort of led us to this impasse. And so we're not recovering alcoholics, but recovering Cartesians. Mm-hmm. And I think that that's the truth of the condition of humanity in the late 20th century. And here we are in this, you know, Cartesian's Anonymous Zen Center.
It's
beautiful. You want to see mind work together.
Yeah. Who's next?
I don't know, Sonia. Do you? You partly changed your life into this in speaking of that one sort of adding analytical to the meditative absolute truth. It seems to make it a cognitive activity that would make it difficult to walk. But in this last, you've been talking about getting down to this level, and it seems like, you know, if it is all of those, that there isn't a paralysis, that the two do complement each other rather than making for a physical danger when you see connection.
Well, maybe that's the solution to the paralytic process. Mm-hmm. I don't know. I mean, See, I'm speaking about this from the point of view of a different tradition than the Zen tradition. I'm speaking about it from the point of view of the middle way tradition, the Madhyamaka tradition, sort of from India to Tibet. It's pretty much in its classical form. And the reality, the view of reality in this tradition is not different than the view of reality in the Zen tradition, but the techniques are in fact different. And so the meditation manuals do talk about different ways to approach these particular issues. It seems that the kind of thing you're talking about is in even the Indo-Tibetan manuals, but is talked about in a different kind of way. For example, if you look at something like, I mean, I'm agreeing with you in a complicated way, all right? Just in case I'm so complicated as to not be clear that I'm agreeing with you, I thought I'd better say that. When you have a sutra spoken by someone like Subhuti or Shariputra, you have these conversations that are going on, like in the Perfection of Wisdom Sutras, where you'll have one of these bodhisattvas saying, well, a bodhisattva is a bodhisattva because he doesn't know he's a bodhisattva. Right? He said, oh, God, you know, those, what the hell does that mean? Right? Well, you know, what he's saying is that as soon as he thinks I'm a bodhisattva, he's not, because in that moment of mind, he's thinking I'm a something, which means that's a thought, not a reality. Okay. And then you say, okay, so he's not thinking he's a bodhisattva, and there's no thought there. He has a moment of mind of just exactly what is, and then he really is a bodhisattva. But the thing is, according to the sutras, the Buddha says, okay, Subhuti, I think it's Subhuti, speaks from the point of view of wisdom, or Shariputra, who speaks from the point of view of non-wisdom, says, okay, Subhuti, you said it right. You got it right. That's the truth of things. Now, so if the Buddha is saying that, it means that when Subhuti was talking, he was talking from the point of view of the perfection of wisdom, which means that he was coursing, as Kanza likes to say, or dwelling in the absolute truth at the time he was talking. Or else the Buddha wouldn't have said you were telling the truth, you see. So what does that mean? So it seems to me that Subhuti is capable of talking from the stance of the absolute truth. So as you say, when it penetrates more deeply, gets down beneath the analytic, it's not merely in the cognitive, right? Then one can act. Because speech is just is a verbal action. Nothing special about it beyond that. It's an action of word rather than a body or thought. So one can speak then, if my interpretation is correct, from out of the absolute truth of things. But for Bodhisattva, it's not a paralytic experience. Only for me is it paralytic. The Indo-Tibetan definition of enlightenment or omniscience, and the Buddha is an omniscient being, the definition is very interesting and relates to this. And Bob Thurman has a great metaphor for this definition, which I steal regularly. He says it's like a double exposure of the absolute, or rather the ultimate, and the conventional. Where a Buddha is capable of existing in the conventional, the world of conventional truth, the conventional fact, and the world of ultimate at the same time. But only a Buddha. For everyone else, it's like you're in one or you're in the other, but not in both at the same time. And so Bob uses this metaphor of a double exposure. I suspect that for great bodhisattvas, it's like the either or for us, which is out here, is like they're a lot closer together. I mean, maybe for a Buddha, they're like literally a double exposure. For us, maybe they're way out here, and maybe for Subhuti, it's sort of stereoscopic, you know, they relate to each other closely in some way. So that somehow these great bodhisattvas are, you know, they're flashing back and forth between the two so rapidly, you know, that they really intertwine in some way.
Fluorescent.
get the idea. I think you're right. I think that it's just not real clearly delineated in the Indo-Tibetan manuals. It's probably more clearly delineated in the Zen teachings about how to be in actively. Well, I think it has something to do with the metaphoric nature of Chinese and Japanese. Because Sanskrit is not a very metaphoric language.
Mm.
Neither is Tibetan. Mm. And I think that the metaphoric language lends a dimension to this that maybe Sanskrit and Tibetan don't. This is raw speculation.
So what's happening when we're eating oryoki in the zendo? And I'm eating the soup, and I can taste that I really like the soup, and I see it as soup. And at the same time, I feel like I'm doing some major work on understanding its emptiness and seeing the animal and the compost as I'm eating this.
Mm-hmm.
So isn't that somewhat of a...
Yeah, it sounds that way.
So we can't kind of do both every once in a while. Like it's not like one or the other.
Right. Yeah, it's like the two are bleeding into each other. And if you think about mind as being moments of mind, you can see how it's possible that one thing arises and then another thing arises. And like the fluorescent flashing, that you're going back and forth between them. But it would be interesting to try and investigate very closely the next time you're eating oryoki and this experience arises as a kind of a learning experience. When you're really into seeing Leon and the compost in the soup, okay, what other qualities are there? You know, when you're deeply into one thing, does it exclude the other? Because you're talking about two types of experience, and they're sort of alternating with each other, and they're sort of blending together and they're alternating. If you could look really closely, it'd be interesting to see how distinct they are at any given moment. That it would be a very interesting exercise in seeing more deeply into the nature of your own mind. Because I think that you'll see them clearly as alternating. You know. But then, of course, that would have some interesting implications, too, because it would raise the question of what is it in you that's observing this alteration between the two, and then that would lead into a whole other depth of experience that would be pretty intriguing. But they're not utterly disconnected. And again, if I reflect on my experience with the concrete that had flaked up, you know, on the one hand, the experience that I had was dependent upon there being some distinctiveness in the situation, like observing the flaked up concrete as being other than the non-flaked up concrete, right, for all these things to come together. And I think that the thing that I want to say to maybe clarify this, and then let's call it quits for the evening, because I have to confess, I just checked out some great murder mysteries. I mean, I was standing in line at the Mill Valley Public Library, right, and then I'll get back to this. I was standing in line at the Mill Valley Public Library behind Daniel, right? I'm holding two Philip, I'm holding two, What?
Philip K. Dick?
No. Who's the Marlo, the detective?
Raymond Chandler.
Yeah, I'm holding two Raymond Chandler mysteries. Yeah, so Daniel's standing there. Daniel's saying, "Well, what are you reading, David?" Raymond Chandler. The Big Sleep. Okay, Daniel, what are you reading? Oswald Spengler's Decline of the West and Hans Kung's Philosophy.
No.
Yes. I couldn't believe it. Couldn't believe it. I thought, what an ironic flop, you know, that we have such a divergent name. It was amusing. I couldn't read two pages of Spengler without falling asleep. I couldn't even read half a page of Hans Kuhn. Anyway, what was my point? Oh, yeah, point.
What was the point? Well, that point was why I wasn't even there.
Oh, wait, I remember what it was. No, it's, you know, I think what I need to invoke here to make things clear is my three truth personal three-truth theory, which is to say that there's two truths and one lie. So this just doesn't discount what I said earlier. But the ordinary world that we live in is not the conventional, the world of conventional truth. It's called delusion. The world of conventional truth, the second truth of the two, ultimate truth and conventional truth, is the world of perceiving the interconnectedness of things. The world that we live in is the world called delusion, where we don't see anything connected to anything. So it seems to me that part of what happens is when we run into the dining room, you know, we just scarf some food and forget about everything because we're hungry and busy talking to our neighbors and you know, thinking about running up to seeing a movie or something like that. That's just delusion. That's the world of straight up delusion, no doubt about it, right? Because it's a world of not noticing anything. Mm-hmm. And a world of radical separation. Okay. So that's why I call that the third truth, which is a lie or delusion. Mm-hmm. But the truth of conventional truth is experiencing the world of diversity and complexity, but in its interconnectedness, because that diverse world truly is interconnected. But when we experience uninterconnected, that's just delusion. So when you're sitting in the zendo eating Oreoki style, and you're experiencing neon in your soup, that is the conventional truth of things, okay? Because you're experiencing the interconnectedness of things, and there's savor and flavor in the soup at the same time. But if in the next moment the soup begins to disappear and you can't exactly find it because you can't separate Leon from the soup and the soup from the Oreoki bowl and subject and object are undistinct and like that, then you're sliding into the level of the ultimate truth of things, because the distinctions, which are interconnected from the conventional point of view, begin to disperse. And then you're sliding into the ultimate truth. And those things can flash back and forth. But in fact, you know, the fact of the matter is that all three can flash back and forth. You know, and you can munch on a carrot and say, oh boy, that tastes great, and get so into the taste of the carrot that you totally have lost track of anything else that's going on. And that can be a great one-pointed experience of a carrot, but it doesn't have much to do with anything else. You know, it's certainly not the ultimate truth of anything. It's just total infatuation.
That's what I was talking about, actually. That's exactly it.
You know what I'm talking about is infatuation. I mean, you know, look, I have to be honest and say that infatuation is a great experience. It's actually preferable to distractedness, but I don't think it has anything to do with spiritual life.
Well, that's one point. And what you were saying with the carrot, if you're doing it totally and completely, taking that bite of the carrot.
Yeah.
But you're disconnected from everything else.
Yeah, but the problem...
But that you're not aware of it, that you're...
Well, this is going to get into a really complicated discussion, because it's going to sound... Because, see, if I say... Depending on what I say here, I might sound like I'm contradicting a lot of stuff that Reb says, and I don't really think that I am. If you're totally into the moment of eating that carrot with complete consciousness of what you're doing, okay, although I said that was infatuation, I called it infatuation because I saw it as an experience which is disconnected from the flow of what's happening, in the larger sense of what's happening. One could say that it is an experience of the one-pointedness of mind and something to be, say, cultivated in Zen, okay, that it is a total focused experience. But I'm thinking of it from the point of view of infatuation as a focused experience which somehow is unconnected with the larger process of what's happening, which I think probably makes it not an experience of Zazen, and makes it, from my point of view, no different than being totally engrossed in a movie, which is a quality of hypnosis rather than a quality of consciousness. Now,
there's something close to that where you can observe yourself and observe infatuation.
Yeah, when you observe your engagement with the carrot.
Even to the point, I mean, observe infatuation.
Yeah, if you're observing infatuation, it's not infatuation anymore, because you have too much consciousness.
Yeah.
Right, and then it's moving.
And yet, it's very, very, very close.
Yeah, but it's different.
Yeah,
and it's moving into the relationship of something like zazen, because if you're one-pointed and aware of it, you see, I think that this is key. If you're one-pointed and aware of that fact, then I don't think it's infatuation. It's not hypnotic.
And yet,
it's not addictive.
And in order to do that, to have that bit of consciousness of what it is, as it seems to be, it helps not to downgrade infatuation.
I understand the point.
It's something we do.
Yeah, I understand the point that you're making, and I realize I was going to be skating on thin ice for the comment that I was making, because on one side is something negative, on the other side is something positive. And maybe another dimension to the issue is whether or not the one-pointedness is something that's occurring under the power of our own intention, or it's occurring under the power of our addictions. You know, it's like I can be really one-pointed about eating a chocolate bar quite easily. My entire mind and attention could get totally sucked up into the experience of eating chocolate. And that's really much more an infatuation, addiction kind of thing. A lot of times I can be aware that that's what's happening, and there's a little more that's happening. But I think because it's driven by the infatuation with the object, rather than driven by the attention to observe what's happening in the moment, I think that it's quite different than the one-pointedness that might be cultivated in Zen. And so in the issue of the carrot, when you're eating Oreoke, and you're totally into it, the question may be what's drawing you. That might be the key.
What's drawing you?
Drawing you. Yeah, maybe the key to disentangling, whether it's an infatuation experience or a one-pointed positive kind of meditative experience, is where is the experience coming from? Is it arising out of being captured by the object, or is it arising out of the mind's training in attentiveness?
Well, how about the example before this class started, when you said you had something, we were talking about your occasionally smoking, and someone said, did you enjoy it? And you said no. I mean, that would seem to be a sort of addictive drivenness, and yet there was the observation sufficient to recognize that it wasn't pleasant.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway.
And that was that, but that doesn't suggest anything particularly meditative about the experience.
I don't know.
Seems to suggest some discrimination.
You're aware of a long breath as you inhale, and aware of a short breath, maybe.
It's from my point of view, it's actually more a matter of being aware of the way in which negative habit patterns have gained control over that moment of my life.
But that could be a meditative experience.
No, I don't think it's a meditative experience. I think it's an experience of discrimination. But that's not necessarily a meditative experience.
I agree with you. But actually, if you allow, I mean, I'm thinking the word allow these things like infatuations or addictions or whatever that have run you, and you try and bring some consciousness to it or whatever, and then use that rather than as a way to turn your mind or study yourself or whatever,
mm-hmm.
then you could turn it towards a meditative experience. It isn't necessarily one.
Catalyst.
Could be.
But it seems like it's using what comes up already that's at hand.
That sounds okay, although in the context of this conversation about vices and being overcome by vices, I mean, let's be more general about this.
Mm-hmm.
Really, the issue is, as far as I can determine, that the only way that you ever get free of those vices is not by just deciding, that's not good, I'm going to stop, because it doesn't really solve the problem, What you really have to do is investigate the nature of the vice and the way it has control over you in all honesty, which means at a certain point in time you just have to look at it as it's there and see clearly what it is. So in the future, when the impulse arises, you can bring some wisdom to the recognition of the impulse and really discriminate what's happening here, and then it doesn't have the same level of control over you. And then because of the nature of how karmic patterns work, which is the more you do something, the more you're going to do it, and the less you do something, the less you're going to do it, you step by step free yourself in the process. That's basically been my experience in regards to any addiction. I'm not saying it's the only way to do things, you know. And as a matter of fact, I know it's not, because my father started smoking cigarettes when he was, I think, 11 or 12. I mean, he's like, you know, 84 now, right? So this is like a long time ago when people did things rather differently and didn't think too much of it. So, you know, when he was in middle age, he'd gotten up to, I think, 3 packs a day of unfiltered Camels. And had been doing that since his 20s. And again, nobody thought anything of it. And then he had a little heart attack and so on and so forth. And the doctor said, okay, here's the story, guy. You stop smoking and you die. You know, and then he told me this interesting thing that happened. And so he was like 60, I guess, or 58 when he stopped smoking. Right? So you can imagine the kind of unbelievable nicotine addiction that this person had. He said he went after he saw the doctor. That's early. He said after he saw the doctor, he went back to his office. He threw out all the cigarettes that he had except for one cigarette. He said he took that one cigarette and he broke it in half and he smoked half of it. And he just smoked it and thought about what he was doing. And then later he had a craving for another cigarette and he pulled out the other half and he smoked it and he thought about what he was doing. He said he never smoked another cigarette after that. And I think that that's true. And I thought that's not an unbelievable act of will. It's something else. It's a remarkable quality of insight. Because no one could will themselves. I mean, you know, if you look at the literature, nobody can will themselves to stop smoking. There's a quality of insight that arose in that situation where he thought about family responsibility and did he want to live and how important were cigarettes and God knows what was going on in his mind. And it makes me think of some of the kind of insights that, you know, are in the Zen literature, where the master says something, goes bang, oh. You know, something, wow, oh, okay. You know, and there's a change after that, which is pretty interesting. And it's also, to me, it's interesting that those kind of experiences don't exist in the Indo-Tibetan literature. I find no references to that kind of thing at all, which is intriguing. I don't know what to make of it, but you don't find such references. So that suggests a different way to deal with addictions.
It's interesting that, I mean, if Indo-Tibetan language is less metaphorical, and it also has no descriptions of those kinds of experiences, I would think, what's left? if there's no description of a sudden sort of satori or enlightenment experience, and then there's no more sort of diffuse metaphorical description.
How do they talk about things, or what? Well, you know, the tradition of the path in this literature is called the graded path, stages, stepwise, step by step by step, increments, incremental. And the although that tradition existed in China, what seems to have dominated, you know, Buddhist thought since since the Tang Dynasty, anyhow, is this kind of notion of sudden awakening rather than incremental development. And the only comment that I can make about this is that there is this, I don't know if you've heard of this philosopher who's now dead for a while, named Gregory Bateson.
Yeah. Okay.
Bateson used to hang around here a lot, you know, and as a matter of fact, he was one of the people that was involved in a group that met here that out of which Lindisfarne Fellowship, and so this guest house is a result of these people meeting here. And Bateson got interested in Buddhism. But anyhow, in his last books, he talked a lot about two ways of knowing. And this is all pertinent here. He talked about two ways of knowing. which he referred to as a digital mode of knowing and an analog mode of knowing. Okay, and you know the distinction between digital and analog. Digital being like a watch that flashes more, you know, like 223, 224, 225, and analog is like a dial. You know?
So it's also kind of like wave and particles.
Could be, yeah, because there's distinctiveness in the digital or in the particle, and there's like flow in the wave. Well, in regards to the way the mind works, another way of talking about these things, the digital mind is also the analytic mind, which makes distinctions. And the analog mind is also the metaphoric mind, which is the mind of similarities. So maybe the thing is that the Indo-Tibetan kind of tradition is much more the digital, the analytic, the stepwise, and has much more exercised that aspect of the mind. And that the Chinese-Japanese has been much more the analog, you know, and has exercised that, the poetic and the instantaneous transformation rather than the stepwise development. I don't know if that's true or not. I've never had this thought. I mean, I just had this thought now, you know, that maybe there's this relationship. So who knows? But it's an interesting question. Interesting question of how language relates to all of this, because of the way in which language has such profound domination over the cognitive process. And in regards to this thing about emptiness, to tie the class up with that perhaps, you know, the third argument for why things are empty is they're empty of all the qualities we impute on them or project on them, which is the qualities of our own mind, which is to say our language, which is making distinctions in the world which are perhaps fictive based upon linguistic structure rather than based upon the nature of what's actually there. So language is really profound in that respect. See you next week if you come.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Indeed.
Okay.